All right, and welcome back to another episode of the Art Beat, which is the new name of the CITR Arts Collective's Arts Report. We're in a new era. We're doing things in a new way. It's actually pretty awesome around here. So you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Today is Wednesday, March 5th, and we are broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia Vancouver campus, which is unceded and stolen Musqueam territory. Indigenous voices in so-called Canada have been systematically devalued and diminished, and this cannot go unacknowledged in broadcast media such as radio. To hear more, please listen to Unceded Airwaves from CITR's Indigenous Collective. And what's more is today we are doing a limited series. This is the first episode in our four-part series called Everything But the Peace, where we're going to be looking at the kind of relationship between everything that goes on in the art world apart from the actual piece of art, with the institution of the gallery, the art school, curators, artists, art students, critics, basically everything you can imagine. And that plays in really importantly to Indigenous rights in Canada, because when we're talking about the institution, it's important to remember that Indigenous people in Canada have been completely, systematically devalued from their knowledge production through the institutional setting, and this is not separate from the art world either. So something to remember for sure and keep in mind as we move forward with our limited series. I'd like to take a second to introduce everybody. My name is Serena. I'm the host of the Art Beat and the host, also of Everything But the Peace. And everyone else, would you like to introduce yourselves really quick here?
Hi, I'm Django.
Hi, I'm Maya Kay.
Hi, I'm Ava.
Hi, I'm Mickey.
Hi, I'm Maya B.
Hi, I'm Margo.
Nice. All right, guys, we're going to go straight into it with talking about, our series. So I want to just take a second to introduce what we're going to be talking about for these next four episodes, and then Margo's going to take it away with a little bit of theory here. So the inspiration for this series came pretty much from my experience working adjacent to the art world and everyone else here at the Arts Collective, and kind of having these experiences of going in to see shows and to do reviews and kind of working within the art world but not completely, and seeing some of the dynamics that were going on between the art, the artist, and that middleman of the institution. So it's quite interesting how the institutions in the art world have the ability to expose art and artists, but they also impose limitations on what can be created and what can be exhibited. So it's this duality of a piece as the artist thinks of it, and then versus how the piece is received by the audience as mediated by the institution through a curator or a seller or even an Instagram account, anything like that. There's always a mediation. And so this dialogue between the artist, the curator through the institution, or any other person involved with the institution, and then the audience, it makes this little pyramid, essentially. So the institution... I'm saying this term a lot, but Margo's going to provide a little bit of context for us here. But it's kind of this thing that's all-encompassing, and people outside of the institution in terms of the art world are still affected by it, because the reason that they are working outside of it and kind of trying to avoid some of the limitations that it imposes, they're still aware of it, right? Like, they're doing this intentionally. So it is this kind of pervasive thing that we're taking a look at that affects people who work in art in all different aspects with all different kinds of goals. And I think that it's something that doesn't have enough attention put on it, individually. So we're going to be taking a look at that for the next four episodes. And Margo, if you'd like to take it away here.
For sure. Okay, so I just wanted to give a little overview of some theories of art and how this can relate to the quote-unquote institution, because I think given the big questions that we're asking, I want to provide a little theory to our mix. So very, very briefly, when we think of art, what art is, you can define it based off of its aesthetic qualities, or you could define it based on how it is created and sustained and the relationships that it necessitates and creates. And so when we think of artists having a relationship with an institution or many institutions, this is very general, but we can also sometimes consider this relationship between art and the institution, as Serena was talking about, to be actually definitive of art itself. So I'm going to name drop a little philosopher here. A guy named George Dickey in the 70s was pivotal in developing the concept of the art world to be that of a social institution. So the art world and the art institution are one. And what this means is that art institutions such as museums and galleries and specific agents working within them have the power to dictate what is art and what is not. And so there's no property of being a work of art other than being deemed to be art by authorized members of the art world. So in this way, artwork is something that is a candidate for appreciation, and this appreciation is only allowed through the conferral of status by people who are allowed to do so. And the status can be provided by specific symbols or being allowed in specific spaces such as galleries, what have you. We're all kind of aware of this. But what was interesting about Dickey's theory was that he didn't necessarily think of the institution as only, let's say, people who curated museums. He thought that anybody who was within this institution included also artists and people who engaged in art. And so this conferral of status wasn't merely something that was provided by, like, elites or people in, like, high places of power within this institution, but anybody who was within it. And so I think going forward with our exciting exploration of art and the institution and the relationship, good and bad, I think it's important to kind of think of how do we define art in the first place. And this is one way to do so. So, yeah.
Yeah, totally. We're going to move into one of our interviews here. So if Maya, you'd like to introduce the interview that we're doing.
Yeah, so with these newfound lenses proposed by Margot, I'd love for you all to hear this new interview that we had with my own poetry professor named Sherita Warner. She took some time, came down to the station, and made a great conversation about her positionality as a poet, an author, and a teacher here at UBC. So please have a listen.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's RIDEON Bike Shop. See you there!
Yeah, first I'm curious is how does working under an institution like UBC kind of shape your artistic voice or process?
Yeah, so I think the main thing is any job that I would have would impact my art practice because art, as you know, the practice of it takes a lot of time, takes a lot of a different kind of depth of engagement and participation. It's really, for me, very sensory, very active, very exploratory and experimental, and that takes a lot of space and time. And so any job that I would have is going to impact that. This job particularly is so interesting because I get to teach the thing that I love, but the teaching itself takes up the time that I would usually have or might dreamily have to create if I wasn't doing this job. So institutionally, it impacts how I teach my genre, and it impacts, or there's a friction for me in just the paradox of teaching poetry in like a really large lecture hall when I would rather just be in a room like this with like eight people and being able to chat.
Because teaching is an art in itself, right? Yeah. There are many considerations that go into that. And that's also another thing I was wondering about is when you're teaching an art, right, what considerations do you have? What are your goals? What do you want people to take away?
Yeah, the dream would be that it feels poetic to be in the room, that it feels like a poem, that the learning that we're doing is collaborative, it's intellectual, it's sensory, and it's emotional. And that's very hard to do in a university. That's a really hard thing to do. I think that emotional aspect of learning and the emotional aspect of engaging in expressing yourself, whatever form that might take, gets pushed over to the side often. It's not like on the surface of our learning.
100%. Yeah, it is almost paradoxical, right? Like art and institution in itself.
Yes.
As an artist, do you find that voice being shaped?
I try not to bring any like grumpiness I might have from working within an institution to my own poetry, but I have more recently tried to bring in the teaching self into my own poems. Some of the engagements that I have with students or with student work is really beautiful and poetic. Some of the conversations I have even in just a drop-in student hour is beautiful. And so I've been thinking about, you know, the ethics around that. Of course, asking permission of students, you said this really beautiful thing. Can I put that in a poem? You know, I have to engage with those kinds of questions. But more also acknowledging that the teaching that I do is potentially part of my creative work, that it becomes part of the outcome. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's something I'm thinking about a lot.
That totally makes sense, yeah. And I also kind of wanted to talk about this idea of artistic truth-telling, right? Mm-hmm. There is some kind of honesty that poetry is very much interwoven with. Do you feel like there is any effect on that honesty that an institution might pose?
Well, I will say there have been poems that I used to bring to class that I don't bring to class anymore. It really depends what's going on outside of the institution as well. So socially, culturally, politically, some stories or poems or creative writing sort of pieces don't quite make sense in a classroom in certain particular circumstances, though I will share it as a recommendation with students if I get to know them one-on-one or something. So that does definitely impact. What I teach is impacted by the environment in which I teach.
And what about what you write?
Mm-hmm. No, I won't let anyone touch it. I think as someone who experiments a lot and writes a lot in notebooks and gives advice to people who are first emerging writers, it's like you have to block all of that stuff out and write what you need to write first and then ask yourself ethical questions afterwards. But in terms of as subject matter or content, or if I feel like I can't write that because I work at this institution. No, I don't feel that.
Have you found any kind of shift as you've grown as an artist? I'd imagine maybe the process has changed, your art-making process, etc.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes, I would love to talk about that because I have shifted it from being a sort of strictly intellectual process to being much more material process. So I am a poet who has an art studio, so I like to collage. I like to think through and with materials, and often that gives me access to language that I wouldn't have otherwise had access to. So I do feel like my process continues to evolve and will always continue to evolve. And I think teaching evolves too. This is the beautiful thing about teaching and poetry and being a poet, is that they all do have these lovely parallels where who I am as an instructor has changed over the years as well. And I want that to be material and sensory as well for students to see me in the act of a process.
Yeah, and, you know, of course you were a teacher and of course you were an artist. However, you were also kind of a consumer of art, as every artist is. I read your collection, Test Piece.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, and one of the motifs that really stuck out was the motif of the gallery, the motif of exhibition and the process of consuming art. And I kind of wanted you to talk about you as a consumer of art. How is that relationship, you know?
I guess I don't really think of it as, like, that word is tricky. That's like an institutional word, right? Consume, that we are like in this business, yeah. right? And I try to counter that or resist that as much as possible. What I will say is that I feel like all art is in correspondence with it. Self, right? So I can look at a painting and write a poem about that painting. I'm honoring that work and I'm in conversation and correspondence with that work. And this has started in ancient times, right? And it just keeps building and expanding. So I love this idea that we're just in conversation with one another. So I do spend a lot of time in front of paintings. With sculptures, I travel and go and look at art. And I just got back from Mexico City. I was looking at art there. And I feel like it changes me. That experience, that encounter shifts something in me. And then that shifts and it's in the poem. And then that moves. And then I share that with other people and they go check out that artwork. Or I just feel like there's this beautiful ongoing conversation for hundreds and hundreds of years with art.
I really like that distinction between, you know, consumption being kind of an institutional word itself and instead art acting as a relationship and acting as this conversation really between everything that has existed before it.
Yeah, I guess when I think consumption, I think like I'm taking something away from the thing and I hope that I would never do that. I don't write about art in that way. I'm not a critic, yeah. right? And I'm an appreciator of art. So I think that we're going to do this in class soon, this ekphrasis, which is the kind of poem making that I like, which is responding to visual art. And ekphrasis itself is this idea that the visual piece can... maybe words can offer something to that piece. This idea that it could be, words could be a gift to a painting, for example, that it could expand what that piece is already doing in the world. And I like that definition of it.
Yeah.
We could expand each other's art in this way.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's a much more beautiful way to look at everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're cultivating this relationship with art, you're seeing these new things and, taking them in. Do you ever have any considerations about where this art is being presented? Do you feel that affects your art viewing process in any way?
Absolutely. I mean, galleries are such interesting spaces. They seem to be kind of restrictive for a lot of people. I remember when my kid was really young and all of the do not touch signs in the gallery made him so mad. And he was just like, this is stupid. Art is stupid. I can't touch anything. And I thought, yeah, this is a very frustrating space for people to be able to engage. After the pandemic, they took a lot of the benches away, which was I think being able to sit for an actual amount of time in front of an artwork is so integral to the process. You know, we skip through things so quickly that... So now those benches are gone that you can't even really spend time. But I'm also... We talked about this last week in class. I'm also a bit of a disruptor. So I will... they have the little stools that you can take. So I will take a stool and I will sit in a space. And I push against what a gallery has to offer. For example, I will spend an hour in a gallery and I will write in my notebook in that space. Some people don't feel comfortable doing that, but I totally encourage people to take up space in a gallery in a different way. You don't have to behave. There's no set of rules, actually, except for the do not touch or like get behind the line or whatever. But you can kind of push against some of that other stuff.
Hey, welcome back. That was our interview with Sharita Warner, a poetry prof at UBC, done by the lovely Maya. Thank you so much, Maya. Maya, any initial thoughts after hearing the interview again?
Nothing, just wow. What a beautiful conversation.
No, seriously.
And she made some great points there, especially about that word consumer, which I've used a lot. And yeah, her points really stuck out to me as consumption being this act of taking away, whereas art is this continuous conversation of giving thought and idea and feeling, and I'm going to keep that with me.
Yeah, I really appreciated that part as well, because it's like we're talking about this concept of where art exists within and outside of the institution, but like actually this is a concept from sociology, from Louis Althusser, that all of our language is imbued with ideology. Like, no matter what you say, that word comes from something and has some kind of meaning. And we're not going to get too much into that, but always just, like, remembering that every word that you're using to describe something came from somewhere. So being intentional even about the language you use to talk about art is, like, something that I think it's so, like, it's no one's fault if you don't do that, but it's so easy to miss. And it's, like, sometimes really good to have that reminder that, like, art can exist in, like, such a pure human, like, natural form outside of the commercial art world, outside of evaluations and grading and price tags. And, yeah, I really like that part as well.
Yeah, definitely. It makes you take a step back and reassess.
Yeah, and one point that really stood out to me in that interview was her highlighting the inaccessibility within a gallery, specifically talking about the removal of benches. And it reminded me of this perspective of another professor I wanted to highlight about inaccessibility to galleries. So this is a quote from Brandon Vickard, a professor and chair of the Department of Visual Art and Art History at York University. And his work predominantly creates public art projects that aim at enriching public spaces. And he said, "Art only has value when it is engaged with the public. When institutions try to restrict access to culture through financial means, such as admission fees, they are only accelerating their own cultural irrelevance." And I thought that this was such an interesting perspective to highlight because we often talk about the impact of inaccessibility on artists and the public audience, and I think what's not highlighted enough is that it directly deteriorates from the meaning of institutions themselves, and that it actually is not only detrimental to us, but it's detrimental to them. And we shouldn't only frame it as something that they are causing to us, but something that they are causing to themselves.
Yeah, totally. It's so interesting to think about that, like, decay of the institution, that, like, because it always needs to regenerate in order to, like, accrue more profit or more, like, notoriety, that it's, like, this, you know, almost, like, running outside of itself, like it's going too fast and like it's going to leave things behind that are actually crucial to like the inner workings of it.
Yeah, and what it leaves behind is its own audience. Yeah. That's what I think is really crucial with that, creating its own cultural irrelevance.
Yeah, that's totally something to think about. Also, our next interview is going to be with Lily Patrick, who's an art student actually in the visual arts department at UBC and a friend and participant, I guess, of the arts collective here at CITR. But that's one of the things that her and I were getting into in our discussion as well, is like when you're thinking about leaving the institution of the art school and going into the institution of the art world, it's like this thing where you kind of are taking on and off all these different roles. Like you're a player in so many different kinds of like scenes of these settings. So just keeping all of that in mind, and thank you so much, Ava, for that insight as well. And this is my interview with Lily Patrick.
We are UBC Electronica, and we love electronic music sessions. Run for them life when I step into the jungle. We offer DJ workshops, open decks, pop-up parties, and more. Follow our socials such as Instagram, Discord, or join us through email, ubcelectronica@gmail.com.
Okay, I'm here today with Lily Patrick, who is a third-year BA student, which is Bachelor of Arts, here at the University of British Columbia. Thank you so much for joining me today, Lily. All right, so I'm here today to ask you about how working within the institution kind of sits on your mind and affects your creative process. So I'll just jump right in with our first question. How does working within the institution shape your artistic voice, if at all?
Well, I find that when I'm working creatively with an institution, I find that I'm less working for myself and more trying to appease my professors or even my classmates. And it's a lot more stressful, just in the sense that I like to compare myself to a lot of other people. So we have things called critiques in all of our visual arts classes, where we basically have a big project and then we present it in front of our entire class and our professor, and we stand up there, describe it for 10 minutes, and then we let the class basically critique your work. And it's nice in the sense that, you know, getting critical feedback is important, and just knowing how people perceive and view your art is kind of interesting. But it's also sometimes a bit stressful, especially when someone doesn't really, like, appreciate your process. And I find that because artists have such vast different point of views, it's kind of creates, like, a lot of blockades, I guess, towards, like, how people create art. And I feel like sometimes in the institution, they teach you how to appease clients and not really yourself.
Yeah, I just want to ask a couple of background questions about the BA program at UBC.
Yeah.
Because I'm in arts, but I'm not in visual arts, so I actually don't know a lot about the visa program. So what do your classes look like? What does, like, the grading system or just, like, that kind of energy typically look like in your visa program?
Well, basically, I'm taking two visual arts classes right now. One of them is a painting class with Carolyn Stockbridge, and the other one is a print media class, which is a silk screening with Dan Starling, I think is his last name. If you were in a BFA, you would basically have all arts classes and an open studio. So basically an open studio is when you have one professor kind of like monitoring your assignments and what you do, but it's basically just a free range to explore any form of art that you want to pursue, and they basically collect a portfolio of art that they've worked on the entire year to present in front of their open studio class, and I will have that next year in my fourth year, which I'm excited about. But I really like the classes, especially my professors that I have now, because sometimes it's hard to find an arts professor that really allows you to explore what you want to explore. A lot of the times it's like, here's an assignment, do it. And you kind of have to, like, regurgitate what the professor likes in order to get a good grade almost. You kind of have to cheat the system, which is not as fun. But I found that with my two professors now, they're very much trial and error, like fail, do something that's not conventionally what you would normally make, and just like explore through experimentation, pretty much. And those are the types of professors that I definitely gravitate towards for art practices, just because they definitely take away a bit from the institution, because they're basically rejecting what UBC wants us to do. And with the grading scale, it's pretty lax most of the time. I mean, if you do the assignment, if you turn it in on time, like, you're not going to get a failing grade. And sometimes people will ask me, oh, like, if your professor doesn't like your art, like, will you fail? No. Like, if they don't like your art, they'll just tell you to your face. And, you know, like, that's probably as bad as honestly getting an F, because you've worked on something for probably 20 plus hours, and all for someone to be like, I just don't like it. That has also happened to me before. But you know what? It makes you stronger and honestly a better artist, because people just aren't going to like your stuff, and you just kind of got to deal with it, really.
Totally. I just want to pull one thing out of what you just said about your profs kind of taking away a little bit and, like, resisting against some of the more, like, institutionalized aspects of, like, being in an educational program for art. What, in your opinion, are kind of those institutional aspects, or, like, you said, oh, what UBC wants you to do, like, in your opinion, what is it, mm-hmm. like, that's different?
I feel like definitely grading art is something that UBC wants you to do, and just, like, education in general, I think that grading art is ridiculous and not very, like, truthful to whatever people are creating. I feel like it adds like pressure onto people to create something that's, like, super extravagant, and it has to be something that they're really proud of, because sometimes you're going to turn stuff in and you're not going to feel very, like, good about it, because maybe you had, like, another class you had to do on top of trying to make a painting that's, like, worth 50% of your grade. But I would say that that's a big one, and also a lot of my peers have always been like, you know, grading art is just, like, not conventional or, like, honestly good. But also, I would just say the freedom that professors allow you to have and just, like, creative expression is very not educational, just because I feel like in university, I've taken, obviously, more than just arts classes, and I found that you follow, like, a very strict rubric. You follow what the professor wants you to do, and you basically take an exam of the things that they've taught you, and if you don't do it correctly, you'll fail the class or you'll get a bad grade, and it's like your life is over almost. But with art, they really, really want you to explore your own personal style and yourself through creative expression. And I really just appreciate that kind of style of teaching and also learning, because I find that that kind of clicks with my brain the most, and it's a way less stressful way of understanding yourself.
Totally. I want to just ask one last little question about the actual visa program, which is just, how does your workload compare to that of, like, another liberal arts student that isn't in the visa program? Because I know you're also doing a minor in journalism, mm-hmm. which is not technically, like, a visual arts class. So how does that, like, do you have emotional or mental, like, differences in, like, doing those two kinds of work? How does that kind of look like for you in your life when you're actually working on assignments?
I feel like working on assignments, honestly, I'm just constantly thinking, will people like this? Which is something that I've been trying not to think, because as an artist, obviously the whole point of art is to, like, reject what other people have taught you, what you're thinking, what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Just kind of, like, I kind of view art as, like, a big protest of everything, almost.
Do you think your relationship to your work, creative work, has changed since starting art school, or do you think that it's largely the same?
I feel like, yes. The medium that I really worked with before wasn't even just, like, a physical media. It was through dance. Like, I really explored that whole realm and that world for 15 years before I came to university, and it was, like, something that I thought I was going to do professionally. And then, I don't know, I came to university and I just realized that world wasn't for me, and I started to take the visual arts classes. In my first year, I took a digital art class, and I think it was, like, Visa 180, which
I
was
took that one too.
Yeah, which was, like, the first half was drawing, the second half was painting, and then I started to realize that, oh, I actually really connect with painting, just because it's also almost balletic in the sense of how you're, like, moving a brush along a canvas, because I feel people think that with painting, it's just, like, a picture from someone's head, like, registered onto a canvas, which is true. But also, I find that with abstract art, which is obviously very popular right now, it's more about, like, the way that you're actually, like, distributing the paint, and you're, like, using your brush, or what kind of brush you're doing, what kind of paint you're doing. I find that, like, everything now has a meaning and a purpose, and that's what I've really learned through the art classes here, because they really teach a lot of theory. And also, just everything that you're doing basically needs to have a meaning, which sometimes is really stressful, because I normally don't create art because I've thought of, like, some grand idea, but I mainly think of an image and I want to see what it looks like as a painting. I feel like, you know, my main form of art right now is definitely painting. It's something that I've just enjoyed my whole life, but I've never really truly explored up until now. But yeah, that's probably, I would say, the theory of art has definitely been ingrained into my head way more since I've come here.
Yeah, I liked a lot what you're talking about with the physicality of art, and that makes me think also about how you were saying that to you, like, any form of art in some ways is, like, a protest against just, like, normative conceptions of the, like, the way we live and, like, the way we interpret things visually. So I want to just kind of go off of that. Like, what role do you think the individual artist, like, such as yourself or another art student or, like, an artist, you know, out of school, plays in resisting or contributing to that institution and, like, to the hegemony, basically, of, like, the things you're being taught. Like, this is the correct way, this is the not correct way, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I find that artists just, like, we love to express our point of view. And, yeah, I think that art is honestly some of the ultimate forms of protest, just because it's a way to express an opinion in a creative way to the mass public. Because, I mean, we have gigantic art museums all over the world. Half of them are about, like, revolutions from war, like, an opinion on a political leader. I mean, even in, like, Renaissance paintings, we have, like, the Romantic era, Romanticism?
Yeah.
Something like that. That whole era of art was even, like, a rejection of the thing that came before that. Then after Romanticism was a rejection of, like, royalty within England and just, like, Europe in general. And I feel that it's really important to keep that going and for artists to really unite on these subjects because, I mean, protest has not gone away and neither has world problems, especially now. And I think that a really interesting way and a really heartfelt and deep way to protest something and to express really important opinions is through art. I guess it's just, like, it helps people, like, make a conversation of a subject because art isn't inherently in your face what the topic is, but you kind of have to figure it out for yourself. And it allows people to learn slowly the things that are being presented and these themes. And it's not just, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. The world is awful. We have to, like, stop doing this because no one's going to listen to someone screaming in their face. Art is a much more gentler way of displaying problems in our world, pretty much. But I also find that the professors want you to explore everything you can, even in a political setting. And, I mean, a lot of my assignments do touch on political issues that are happening in the world today. So many people have so many different styles. And even just seeing things in museums and just popular artists in general, no one is a bad artist. Nothing can make you a bad artist. And honestly, it's a mindset. And institutions, because of, like, portfolio use and also just finding, like, the most elite people to teach, pretty much, don't let that ever discourage you from actually creating something that you really want to create. Don't compare yourself to other people, and also don't let rejections stop you from actually pursuing something that you know you want to do.
Okay, thank you so much, Lily Patrick, for being interviewed, and that was a lovely interview. I was so honored to do that with you. And I also had the honor of attending a performance art piece called Sculptural Rebirth at the Vancouver Art Gallery with the very same Lily this weekend. So the next little clip we're going to play is just our kind of review of that piece, but it's kind of an interesting thing to tie into the other concepts that we're talking about today, because this is a piece that was presented at the very institutional Vancouver Art Gallery, arguably the biggest and most kind of classic art world institution gallery or viewing space in Vancouver. And we definitely talk a lot about the audience that we saw there, the kind of energy surrounding the piece, or the performance, I guess, kind of describes it a little bit better. But yeah, we're going to be talking about that and then kind of debriefing Lily's personal interview and the Takamine installation together in a couple minutes here. So stay tuned. Just a reminder, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is The Art Beat. We're doing our special episode right now, first episode of Everything But the Piece. So if you're liking our kind of narrow focus energy that we have going on, there's going to be three more episodes just like this. Super awesome. This is the Tadasu Takamine installation coming up next.
Hi there. You're listening to CADR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC Vancouver campus, located on the unceded ancestral and traditional lands of the Hunkaminim-speaking Musqueam people. We honor the ancestral and ongoing care for this land by the host nations. Media practices are often rooted in white gaze, and we recognize that it is our responsibility to shift our approach and move towards radical empathy. While we broadcast from UBC Vancouver campus, our listenership extends to the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations and beyond. We encourage you to check out native-land.ca, that is native-land.ca, to learn more about whose land and territory you live and work on or may be visiting. Thank you.
We had the pleasure of attending a piece of performance art this weekend at the Vancouver Art Gallery. It was put on by an artist named Tadasu Takamine. He's from Japan. And it also was put on by students from Emily Carr University. So it was a really cool, like, collaborative piece, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the piece was, like, just to kind of describe it, it was, I want to say, six people sitting down.
Yeah.
And they were basically naked. They were wearing, like, bald caps also.
Yeah.
And, like, wearing just, like, skin-colored, like, bathing suits, basically.
Yeah, bra and underwear, and covered with saran wrap.
Yeah.
As well.
And they were, like,
Vaseline'd up.
Yeah, they were oiled up. And then there was a model, like, a live drawing model, who was sat there, and then they were all, like, drawing her, and then one by one, they were kind of, like, taken, not aside, but, like, kind of singled out by the, like, microphone person. I don't know what to call them. Like, microphone assistant, I think they literally called them.
Yeah.
And then they would have, like, kind of a little bit of a speech talking about
what rebirth means to them.
Yeah.
And what they would bring with them if they were to be reborn at this moment in their life.
Yeah. Like, this other crew came in of, like, three or four people that would, like, paint them with plaster and, yeah, like, and, like, canvas and, like, yeah, put it on them and make this kind of shell, essentially, like, shell of a body. So they were all painted, like, all white.
Essentially, they were covered in plaster completely and just left to sit for, honestly, like, close to an hour. 70 minutes was the entire duration, yeah, of the performance, and holding a staff, yeah, as well. They were all seated, but this performance has also been exhibited at multiple different galleries.
This is the first time in Canada, though, ever.
Yeah, first time at Canada at the Vancouver Art Gallery, which we were really lucky to see.
Yeah, super lucky, especially because Takamine's other work is, like,
yeah,
so interesting. Like, his background is really great. He's actually, like, really interesting artist and, like, kind of controversial, because some of his other pieces have been kind of really focusing on, like, physicality of the body. Like, I know that one of the things that he actually mentioned during his kind of introduction before the performance was that he primarily works in, like, theater performance, and so, mm-hmm, something like this is, like, slightly different than his, like, day-to-day art-based practice.
Yeah, and it seems like he puts himself into a lot of his art, whereas this was very much a display of actors, pretty, yeah, much, and he was the director of it.
Like, his concept, but he wasn't a player in it at all. Like,
yeah.
He wasn't there.
No, he didn't show up once.
Yeah.
Well, I thought he was going to.
I thought so, too.
I thought he would, like, he was going to be the live model, honestly.
That
would have been kind of fun. Yeah, but, yeah, we got sidetracked. But as the people were drawing within these, like, suits, almost, after each member was plastered, which sounds funny, the live model then spoke from a book of Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And,
like, quite a few excerpts from Nietzsche, and they were chosen at random.
Yeah,
she stood up and she said, like, I'm going to read from this book of Nietzsche. They didn't introduce which book it was either. I don't know.
It had a black cover. That's what I saw.
Yeah. And then,
and it seemed like a poetry book.
Yeah.
Almost.
And then so they just said some, like, excerpts from the book.
Yeah. But then they intentionally chose for the last quote to be the last page of the book, which was like the conclusion, which is what I noticed. Yeah, and then they walked off and they never came back. And after they read all these quotes, all of the performers who were plastered then started to move and basically break out of the shell that they'd been encased in and got out of the chairs that they were sitting in and basically walked out, were rebirthed out of this plaster.
Yeah, and they left behind, like, the outline of their bodies, essentially, like their seated, their seated plaster shell, which was really interesting to watch them actually, like, crackle and, like, slowly, like, escape this shell in, like, a very, like, it was pretty obvious that, like, this was their rebirth and they're coming out of their cocoon. Like, the symbolism of that was pretty clear.
Honestly, I was thinking the whole time just how physical that experience must be to sit so still and so silent with your eyes closed for 70 minutes is so grueling on your body.
And the, like, artists, the performance artists afterwards were, like, shaking. Like, you could tell they were cold and, like, kind of, like, I think it did take a little bit of a toll on them. They were happy to be there, obviously, but, like, I do think it was kind of, like, it was also very vulnerable. Like, all of their speaking parts were, like, very vulnerable about, like, their lives, their mental health struggles. And I think that it is really interesting, like, that this is such a personal project for, like, those artists. Like, they're literally there naked talking about, like, their personal things, like, in their lives, like, separate from their artistic selves.
Yeah.
Not separate, but, like, just elements of their life and, like, why they would want to change things about their life. But then it's not technically their piece, right? Like, it's a different director, which is why it's so interesting that it's, like, this thing that's super, super personal, but also, like, not that personal because it's, like, this is the third time it's been repeated.
Yeah, true. Honestly, I kind of wish, I think it would have been even cooler. Obviously, this isn't possible because legally I don't think that they could have done this, but if they were actually fully nude within the piece, I feel like that just would have added, like, an even more, like, personal touch to it, just on, like, an artist lens, because obviously I don't think in a public gallery that might not be allowed, but also Takamine's work really, like, focuses a lot on, like, sexual desires and just, like, the nature of sex in general through a lot of his works, which I find really interesting because I was talking to my friend about this the other day, especially in institutions and in schools in general, people don't really push the envelope of incorporating sex or lust or desire or any form of taboo-ness like that. People don't really harness that ever because they're scared that someone's going to take it down or it's not going to be as accepted as it normally is. But I really like that he's doing that, even though within his own country, his works are being, like, taken down for pushing an envelope like that from his own society.
And just to counter that, like, I had kind of a different understanding of the, like, sexual being kind of element of the work where it's, like, sometimes that can be kind of cliche where it's, like, I do think a lot of artists gravitate towards sexuality or nudity just because it is, like, something that classical art has been using as, like, a evocative element for a long time. But I thought that this was, like, actually very desexualized in terms of, like, the naked body.
It was very tastefully done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And super. it's really interesting to think about how this was with, like, students who were talking about their own experiences and that this was, like, a program that was put on by their school. Like, they literally signed up through their classes and, like, one of their profs, like, helped to manage this. So it's, like, this artist that is actually really controversial in his, like, hometown, or I guess his home country in general, like, most of his credentials that we were looking at come from North America. Like, he's worked in North America in a lot of ways at, like, a lot of different, like, centers for arts, like SFU, at Banff, stuff like that. But also, like, he still does live in Japan. Like, he still does live in Tokyo. So it's, like, it's interesting that he kind of, like, comes over here to do these presentations that are more taboo where he's from, and then he kind of goes back to, like, teach his students and, like, have maybe a slightly different, like, artistic practice.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to think about the role that, like, Emily Carr as an institution, like, enabling him to have access to these students and, like, their personal and, like, vulnerable selves, like, really plays in making the piece come alive.
Yeah. I just, like, wonder his connection to Vancouver as well, because he did, it says in his biography or something that I read, that he did a residency at SFU as well. So I wonder what his draw is to Vancouver, if Vancouver is just more accepting of his work rather than, I don't know, things in even America or on the East Coast in Toronto or Montreal.
Yeah, and I think that, like, that's kind of about that free will of creation that you and I were just talking about, like, privately, is, like, that element of, like, to create is to be free, but also, like, you're creating for an institution and you're getting paid, and this was a ticketed event, and, like, you're not actually even in it. You just came up with the concept. So it's, like, there's so many layers, like, it's so many layers far removed from just that, like, almost pure sense of creation, which doesn't devalue the work or, like, the creative effort, but it does make it, like, really come alive in the institutional setting and, like, kind of think about, like, could this performance be held outside of a gallery space?
Yeah.
And, like, it was, like, a very specific kind of audience member that was there. Like, there was a lot of people, like, curators that I recognized from other galleries, staff of, like, the Vancouver Art Gallery. Like,
and just, like, older people in general.
It was quite, like, a homogenous group of, like, people that clearly are affiliated with the art world. I wouldn't really say I saw anybody that wasn't, like, that just kind of was there for fun or, like, didn't seem like they were kind of tapped in, like, from the working side of things.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting to think about. Like, this is not a performance that was put on to, like, a completely, like, innocent audience, I guess, for lack of a better term. Like, these were people that had some kind of knowledge of Emily Carr or of him or of at least Vancouver Art Gallery or at least of just performance art in general going into it. But, like, what would this performance mean to people that had never seen something like this or didn't even have these, like, conceptions of performance art?
Precisely.
I think it's also really interesting that some of his other work is a lot more controversial. Like, we were looking at one called God Bless America that is really cool. But a little bit more, like, directly, like, overtly, maybe not overtly sexual in itself, but, like, has sexual elements and, like, has much more political elements, like, very directly. Like, it's slightly less personal in some ways. And it's hard to describe because it is a really interesting work, actually.
Yeah, and but, it poses a lot more questions about why the artist is doing this. I felt like the sculptural rebirth was very straightforward, which is also fine. Sometimes art is just very direct like that.
But it's interesting that this more, like, tame artwork is the one that's being toured and the one that is being, like, lauded by these different institutions. And, like, he's giving talks at Emily Carr today and, like, things like that. So it's interesting that, like, the way that controversy is a fine line, like, controversy because of God Bless America, which he did make, like, that video is over 20 years old.
Yeah.
So it's, like, it helps to add to his, like, repertoire and his reputation. But it's also, like, that controversy, like, could have gone the other direction.
True.
And it's interesting that, like, these art institutions celebrate him for pushing the barriers and for kind of being this, like, free thinker. But also the piece that we actually did see in the institution was one that was significantly more genteel than the works that he's actually known for up until this point. So I also, I wonder if that has to do with just, like, aging and having different themes and ideas on your mind. But I also, like, this was a lot less political of a piece, which just makes me think, like, Emily Carr and Vancouver Art Gallery were much more, like, I don't know.
It was definitely, like, a validity switch,
as a piece. But it's just, like, interesting that that's the piece that, like, these places were really interested in.
Yeah, true.
It's a lot more, like, unique to the setting also, like, with a touring performance piece like this. Like, I think it is a really cool idea to have different people involved that are telling their own, like, personal stories.
Yeah.
So, like, every time it gets put on, like, it takes a whole different direction.
Yeah, truly.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre, the SASC, is a free and confidential service which provides support to those who experience sexual assault, intimate partner violence, and harassment. We provide services to folks of all genders, including students, staff, faculty, and those who have a connection to the UBC Vancouver campus. We provide crisis and short-term emotional support, legal, medical, and campus-related advocacy, and outreach and educational programs. We are located in the Student Nest, room 3130. For more information on our hours of operation and other resources and services, please go to our website, amssasc.ca, or visit our Facebook page, AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre.
All right, welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to The Art Beat by The Arts Collective, and we're doing a limited series called Everything But the Piece. You just heard a little review of the performance art piece Sculptural Rebirth that happened at the Vancouver Art Gallery this weekend. Me and Lily Patrick, who was interviewed earlier on today, were able to attend that. And so once again, a huge thank you to the Vancouver Art Gallery for making that possible. Any last thoughts about anything that we heard today, guys?
I mean, me personally, I'm just kind of wishing that I attended. Seeing those photos, hearing the concept itself, I think that's really interesting. And I'd be really curious to see what the differences were in each location that the piece toured, being different performers, different life experiences. I really do wish I went. However, there's a bit of inaccessibility that I find is tied to the Vancouver Art Gallery and those ticket prices.
Totally.
Student ticket prices.
And this was also like an additional ticket price on top of your admission price as well. Mm. So it was like very inaccessible. And it was interesting because like the different levels of membership would get you cheaper ticket prices for this. And one of the things that me and Lily were talking about in our little debrief here is that it seemed like it was almost exclusively people who worked within the art world that were actually attending. Like, there was a lot of Vancouver Art Gallery employees. I recognized some curators. Like, I recognized the head curator of the Polygon and, like, things like that. So it was, like, a very kind of homogenous audience, which isn't a bad thing, but it's also, like, you know, who else could be seeing this and have different thoughts and different takes, and like how could this be powerful for people who aren't like already aware of who this like quite famous touring artist is?
And if the money was going like fully to the students, that would be one thing, but the VAG just like takes it. So
yeah, I have a feeling that this was perhaps not a paid situation for the Emily Carr students.
And that's crazy because, like, can't get much more vulnerable than that. Like, you're literally stripped of your clothing and then also, like, telling, like, these personal stories.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, yeah.
And when art isn't made for anyone except for other artists, what's the point?
Yeah. That's a really good question to leave off on. We're going to revisit questions like that in our next episode next week. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope everyone has a great evening.
Prophecy Sun coming at ya. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Black sugar, yeah.